The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Now, let's, I talked to, how shall I put this, Silva Says, because he's involved in that series along, this concerns the MOOC commentary, that the series is being picked up by Erdmans, but also that involves then the stipulation is that MOOC, they're not going to publish it as two volumes. But he is to rework what would have been the second volume along with the first published volume as one volume, which Erdmans is going to use to replace Murray in that series. Not particularly happy about that, but I'm sure someone will pick up the Murray commentary. It will be available, and then the MOO will be coming out in the near future as one volume. So that's the... scoop on that. Now, we were looking last time on this voluminous outline sheet at the second point, looking at some of the special introductory questions, just touching on them in many instances, to highlight certain concerns that we need to be aware of, at least, even if we don't even settle them all along, in for the theological dimensions or facets that are involved looking into Romans. And we had been talking then, first of all, about the question of authenticity. We said something about place and date. And a fourth point, we're looking very briefly at matters of origin, looking at the Church of Rome as to its origin and then its composition. I believe that's where we were at the end of the time last time. Forget exactly what I said. I'll just be very quick here. There are, of course, traditional attempts, and by traditional I mean particularly Roman Catholic efforts to link Peter with the beginnings of the church at Rome. But in fact, the measured judgment is that we just don't know. Although the existence of a church there is certainly not surprising, given the importance of Rome and the movement possible in the Mediterranean world at this time. So there is a large Jewish population that is present there, and we know that particularly from, I did mention this, the edict of Claudius that is mentioned by Suetonius. I won't comment further on that because I'll give the substance of that in a slightly different context in just a moment. So, at least by the middle of the century, that's the case. Now, as to the composition of the church at the time of Paul's writings, that remains a matter of debate, although I think it's fair to say, at least as I read the commentaries and some of the other specialized discussion, it seems to me that we are settling in a certain direction, maybe more so than has been the situation traditionally. The question here, to be more specific, what is the mix of Jew and Gentile, Jew and non-Jew, in the church? Is it predominantly Jewish with a Gentile minority, or is it the other way around? Just to give some citation here, we better not take the time to look at the passages. I don't think it's really necessary. You can do that on your own. Those looking at things from the side of a predominantly Jewish makeup appeal to the passage like 2:1 and following, 7:1 and following, those under the law know, and then obviously chapters 9 through 11 function to accent readers with an Old Testament background, at least presumably Jewish. On the other side, the Gentile, predominantly Gentile character of the church, appeal is made to 1:6 and 13, 11, 13 and following, some passages that we'll presently have the opportunity of presently have the opportunity of looking at, and yeah, that applies to 15 and 16 as well. Now, to cut through the discussion, just come to kind of a conclusion, I'm fairly well impressed with the sort of scenario that Dunn details in his commentary. And you can check him out there. I know that I don't have the pages down here, but you'll find it under the heading. The way he describes things or profiles the situation makes a lot of sense. We can set it out here under a couple of points. First of all, is the existence of a Jewish community in Rome, a well-established community, going back its roots there already in the first century B.C. A community made up of natural-born Jews and God-fearers. It's in that setting, then, secondly, that Christianity comes. The church emerges within this Jewish community. Converts to Christianity from that. So that we can anticipate or presuppose a synagogue focus to the earliest evangelizing efforts in Rome by whoever. But the nub of this consideration is that Christianity as emerging in Rome, established there, is a primarily, essentially, a Jewish Christianity. A Jewish Christianity. Then a third factor, we have to recognize with the whole state of affairs that lies in back of the Edict of Claudius, documented, as we said, by Suetonius, the Edict of Claudius issued in 49 A.D. There's just not a whole lot we can get a hold of, but it seems from what's said that you're pointed to you can draw at least some definite conclusion. Claudius refers to the Suetonius refers to an edict of Claudius by which he expelled Jews from Rome because of the constant disturbances at the instigation of Crestus, as is the Latin spelling. Now, on the assumption that this is a reference to Christ, this would appear to point towards some turmoil that had come within the Jewish community, occasioned, it would appear, by the gospel, of such a character that it comes to the attention of the authorities, and they handle that going right up to the emperor by a edict of exile. And that, again, by the way, would seem to indicate a fairly large community, because that would create that much attention to those concerned with the general public order. So at that point, then, the status of Jews, both non-Christians and Christians, becomes vulnerable, ambiguous so far as their citizenship is concerned. And obviously, from the point of view of the Roman authorities, the distinction between Christian, non-Christian, and Christian and Jew is not going to have a great deal of, that's not going to be a great deal of interest. So that as that Jewish onus carries over to the Christian community, more and more Christian Jews exit Rome, with the result that Gentile Christians, who have as a minority been coming in all along, remain. So if the scenario is something like that, the situation then that we have by mid-50s, which is, as you recall, when Paul is writing, can be captured this way. It's a church in which the center of gravity, because of these recent developments, the center of gravity has shifted from Jew to Gentile, but in which a Jewish minority remains, and perhaps Jews are beginning to return again to Rome. But anyway, I think that sort of profile makes sense historically, and it explains then how both are in fact addressed in the letter and with the distinctive emphases that we find. Now, of course, you'd have to prove all that out to test that thesis, that scenario, by working through these and other passages. But I'm just saying I think that will likely prove very tenable. So I would say the conclusion we want, so far as exegesis is concerned, we can at least say this, that there are substantial numbers of both. The Gentiles and minority are in the minority, but they're not certainly not minimal or insignificant minority. Excuse me, the Jews. Thank you. No, that's right. Get it right. the Jews are in the minority at this time, without trying to decide relative proportions. So that on the makeup of the congregation. That becomes an important question, particularly as you get into the whole issue of the way in which law, Paul's view of the law, is addressed in Romans. Fifth, stop me if there are any questions as we go on. Yes?
Whether it was 64 years, 40, 60, or 37 years, 70, yeah. 30, is it really going to make an exegetical difference?
Well, let's not prejudge that. I think it does make some, I don't have a good example right at hand.
What about like chapter 14, the question of being the third or the tenth power of the Jews and the Syrians?
Right.
And then chapter 16, the false teachers and the Antinomian or some other, or Judaism.
Right. Good. Those are good suggestions. Now, again, how much of a percentage, obviously, I don't think that's an important question, but I think a predominantly Gentile readership will make most sense. Now, how decisive that is exegetically, that's another question that I don't know that you could answer in general. You have to just take it, situation by situation. As to the occasion and purpose, now, first of all, the occasion. The occasion for Romans is quite plain. You can see that at either end of the document. Looking at 1:8 through 15, at least the beginning of verse 15, 15 and the beginning of verse 16. And then in chapter 15, verses 14 through the end of the chapter, 14 through 33. Now, what are we told there? This, in effect. Paul has completed his missionary work in the East over the preceding years. That is in Asia Minor, in what we now call Greece, Macedonia North, Achaia South. He's completed that missionary activity, and he proposes to shift his activity to the west, more particularly to the area identified as Spain in 1524. But before he does that, he has in mind taking a collection from the churches in Greece to Jerusalem. So he's in a situation where he's poised actually to go east from where he is, presuming the letter's written in the area around Corinth, in or around Corinth. He's going east to Jerusalem with this offering, and then he proposes to come back west and onto the far end of the Mediterranean to stop off in Rome. Now, what he has in view, it appears, so far as Rome is concerned, as it indicated, is to just stop there, spend a short while to meet the church, to have fellowship, and it would appear also to secure their support for this missionary venture to the west. Now, that much seems clear enough from these passages. But then, if we raise this question, why does he write at the length that he does? Why does he write in the vein that he does? Seen in terms of his travel plans indicated here, that seems a bit of overkill. What is the purpose that he has in writing the document as a whole? What are the set of reasons that shape it, give it its overall character? As Cranfield puts it in his commentary, 1:8 through 16 and 15:14 and following are easy to explain, but why at all do we have 1:16b through 15:13? In other words, the body of the letter. That prompts us then to go on and say something about the issue of purpose. Now, this could be a large discussion, one that I'm not going to get at in any extensive way. Almost entirely here, just to set certain boundaries to the discussion, set up certain parameters for addressing this question. Just leave it to you as you had interest to pursue it in the various commentaries. Because this is a matter of rather, continues to be a matter of rather energetic discussion. And really at the center, pretty much at the center in contemporary study of Romans. You can see it, for instance, in the Donfried collection that I referred you to last time, the Romans debate. You'll see a number of pieces there addressing this issue. Now, as an orienting question, we can put matters this way. Is Romans addressed to a particular historical situation or not? Is it addressed to a particular situation or not? Now, on the one hand, we can say that there is pretty much of a consensus that it is addressed to a specific historical situation. In fact, that specific situation is quite essential to the shape, of Rome and to the scope of the discussion. Now, this consensus as to a specific historical situation, that is bound up pretty much with the emergence of the modern era of biblical studies the emergence of historical critical study, that is a self-conscious commitment to understand the scriptural, the biblical documents in terms of their historical context. It's an approach that begins with F.C. Bauer, his effort to explain Romans within the concrete struggle that marks earliest Christianity. You remember how that went, the basic primal conflict between Jewish or Petrine Christianity, Gentile Pauline Christianity. And that sort of approach, insisting that Romans has to be understood in terms of a particular historical state of affairs, that can be seen to be in reaction to what has been the more traditional, I think we can say more often, or at least often unreflecting assessment of Romans. And that is the way the tendency to approach Romans, particularly in the Pauline corpus and in the New Testament, as a more or less timeless, in the sense of historically unqualified, theological treatise. The modern era of biblical scholarship has been in reaction against viewing Romans as a theological treatise. As Melanchthon, for instance, puts it, it's a summary of the Christian religion. Christianae Religionis Compendium. A compendium or summary of the Christian religion. Just on that point, we might just very quickly observe in passing what counts against that that summary of doctrine approach. Although a little bit later on down, we're going to see there's a large element of truth to it as well. But what really, in the strict sense, what counts against that is that there are important aspects of Christian doctrine, say of Christology and eschatology, that are not present in Romans. And additionally, there's nothing on the Lord's Supper or on church order. So there is this general consensus that Romans has to be understood as addressed to a particular historical situation. But on the other hand, there is no consensus on what that situation is, what the specific historical situation is being addressed. And we can say that as that question is wrestled with, there are basically two streams or two strands of answer. There are those views who look for the specific circumstances in the situation at Rome, and we'll talk, we'll illustrate that at least in just a moment. But distinguished from that are those approaches that accent that the historical particularities of Rome are explained more by the specific circumstances of Paul. In other words, the specific factors are sought either on the side of the recipients or on the side of the author. So the difficulty for the Roman address, we've already indicated and touched on it in a way. It can be put this way. Why would Paul write in the extensive and yet not really completely comprehensive way that he does? Why would he write in this extensive fashion to a church that he has never met? Now, a number of explanations have been given to try to satisfy that question. One motif of explanation is that of Paul's impending trip to Jerusalem with the collection, and accenting now especially the symbolic significance of that collection. That is, that it seals the bond between Jew and non-Jew in the gospel. Primarily, Gentile Christian congregations of the Greek peninsula are contributing to the needs of the primarily Jewish church in Jerusalem. That Paul writes Romans then with this impending trip to Jerusalem in view, and especially as he is fearing conflict with the Judaizing element that is present there. So a large question in Paul's mind is, will Jerusalem, will the church there accept him and the offering he bears, accept his ministry to the Gentiles? So that what Paul is doing in writing to the Romans is with a view toward getting them on his side, getting their favor and support, the support of this important and cosmopolitan church. A kind of extreme, I guess, I don't know if that's a fair word, but a very rigorous use of this line of explanation is seen in a scholar like Jacob Gervell, who says that the real target of the argumentation in Romans is the church in Jerusalem. And he even refers it as, he refers then to Romans as the letter to Jerusalem. And that, I think, without entering into an evaluation of things here, I think would be kind of overstating this general concern. Another line of explanation for why Paul writes just as he does to the Roman church is the apparent inconsistency of going to Rome in the light of chapter 15, verse 20. Let's turn there and the apparent inconsistency of 15:20. We're going to look at it right now. What Paul expresses in 15:20 is his aspiration to preach the gospel where Christ has not been named, in order so that he is not building on someone else's foundation. To preach the gospel where Christ has not been named in order not to build on someone else's foundation. In other words, the Pauline commitment not to go where the gospel has already been, or as Germans have a wonderful mouthful for this principle. This is the nicht ein Mischungsregel. The what?
The Star Trek principle.
I guess you could call it that if you want. The principle of non-interference or non-involvement. In light of that, it's posited that Paul is laying out here a certain groundwork in advance so that he can come and give believers at Rome their apostolic foundation as a church. That heretofore the gospel has come through non-apostolic bearers. And so his concern, in spite of the nicht ein Mischungsregel, is to provide this apostolic founding. And again, that might have something to it. I'm not sure that you could really, how far you can press that is for providing an explanation. Now, looking at an example in the other direction, seeing the specific circumstances grounded not so much in Paul's audiences, but in Paul himself. the point made here is that Romans comes at a time, is written at a time, when Paul sees himself coming to the close of his ministry. Romans represents a document in which he pauses in this interim between his missionary efforts, finished in the East, proposing to move on to the West, but at the same time not foreseeing an extended period there. He pauses to reflect on his ministry in the light of all that has taken place. So it has been proposed by someone like Gunter Bornkamm that Romans is Paul's theological last will and testament. And that, it's proposed, explains both the level of generality that we find in the letter, that there is so much there that is not tied to one specific church situation. And in, I think you can see here, in some respects, we have a return here to kind of to something like the traditional compendium notion of Melanchthon and others. Now, again, let me just break this sort of observations off, because my intention here in getting into this question is not to discuss it extensively, and certainly not to reach firm conclusions. Those can only, I think, be arrived at by more careful examination than I propose to do here. I think we want to do in terms of the design of our course. But to alert to the issue, and especially draw this capital out of it. And we can do that by making use of an observation that comes from Casaubon. I think he does, this would be on pages 390 and 91 of his commentary. He points us, I think, in a sound direction in this whole area of question, however else we're going to study it further. On the one hand, Casaubon observes, Romans as a whole has a marked reflective, a notably reflective character about it. You can't get away from that. So that Romans is fairly seen as presenting a summary of Paul's theology, at least major elements of Paul's theology, developed in a reflecting fashion. Even if it's not comprehensive or exhaustive, and there are polemical elements involved. So on the one hand, Romans has that summary reflective character, but it is not simply a teaching tractate. It does belong to a particular situation. The other side of the matter is that Romans is clearly written out of a deep concern for us for the spread of the gospel. It's written with quite concrete missionary aims in view. I want to go to Spain. But at the same time, accenting this, Romans is not centrally a missionary communication. That's not basically what Romans is, a missionary communication. So from this this matrixing of things, if that's a verb, categorizing, Casaubon proposes that the task of understanding Paul's purpose in Romans consists in being sensitive and seeking to clarify the relationship between these two aspects, the undeniable theological and the undeniably missiological or evangelizing concern. Got to hold those two together without taking away from the one or the other the importance that it has by focusing unduly on one or the other. So that particularly a systematic theological approach to Romans can be feel the valid impulse of the Melanchthon approach, compendium of doctrine, and yet at the same time needs to be sensitive that the whole is qualified by these this mix of missiological or evangelizing concerns. Or if you pick up on Dunn's discussion, I think it's fairly close to that of Casaubon. The essence of what he argues is that what we have in Romans is a compelling mix of missionary, apologetic, and pastoral concerns, all blended theologically. And that's the factor there that we can highlight. All right, sixth. Let's just touch very briefly here on a question that came up last time in our discussion, and that's the integrity of the document. And I'll draw attention to three areas where integrity has been questioned. And don't at all intend here to get into particularly defending the integrity, which I'm presupposing in our own work, but just to be aware of these issues, because it has its definite bearing on several points it has definite theological bearing. Particularly with the emergence of historical critical method, the integrity of the document has been questioned. For instance, Bultmann, and it's not just Bultmann because he's been followed by a number of others. Bultmann and others maintain that there are brief glosses, non-Pauline glosses, throughout the document. Again, we won't look at them here. Just let me note them, and you can, particularly as it might bear on a passage of your special interest, be aware of that. 2:16, 6:17b. Perhaps most important, well-known, 7:25b and 8:1 is non-Pauline. And then 10:17. More substantially, at least so far as extent of material is concerned, questions have been raised about the relationship of chapters 15 and 16 to the rest. That happens in view of evidence which points to the existence in the 3rd century already of a text ending at 14:23, that is at the end of chapter 14. And also some uncertainty in the textual transmission as to the placing of the closing doxology. That is in our text 16:25 through 27. That appears at different places, for one at the end of chapter 14. So that some have proposed that the original ended at chapter 14 and that 15 and 16 are un-Pauline. Very quickly, though, the shorter text is best explained as the work of Martian, who you might say is the first in the Tübingen school, precursor. Origen, for instance, tells us explicitly that Martian cut off chapters 15 and 16. Um, So most everybody today is convinced as to the homogeneity of 1 through 15. They belong to a letter of Paul to Romans. However, fairly popular is the view that chapter 16 is not part of the letter. A large number of people taking that position want to argue that it's Pauline, that is the whole of a part of a letter that was originally sent. Welcome back to your special introduction days. To where? Anybody? Ephesus, right. A letter to Ephesus. Because of the argument here runs because of the number of people Paul greets, the reference to Priscilla and Aquila, and the fact that Paul, how would Paul be greeting all these people in a church that he's never been at? But I think on reflection, those arguments are certainly not compelling, and we have to be aware that there is no textual evidence whatsoever for 16 being detached from 1 through 15. maybe I could have just said, in view of the nature of Rome, its strategic location, and the movement that there is in the Mediterranean world, it's quite understandable that Paul would know people, have had contact with people there, even though he'd never been there. Fairly widespread today, then, is the fact that the doxology at the very end is not original, or even Pauline. And in the discussion, without addressing that here, just refer you, especially Murray's commentary, at the very end, pages... in volume 2, pages 262 to 268, address that question, I think, helpfully. So that sketch on integrity. 7. Let me just say something finally here to round off these points as to the structure, basic outline of the document. Primary divisions. How you break things down further, obviously, can be debated. Let's just represent it this way, very roughly. 1 through 7 is the letter opening, the so-called exordium, and with its elaborations, it reflects the stereotype of the opening of the letter in Greek, the Hellenistic letter of that time. 1:8 through 15, we've already noted. 1:8 through 15, as well as then 15:14 and following. The rest of the document, deal essentially with Paul's relationship to the Romans, his personal plans. So that then what is bracketed by these two units is 1:16 through 15:13, the main body of the letter. Which has a flow something like this, just very general. 1:16 and 17 expresses the controlling theme. There could be some debate where that theme actually begins formally. We'll talk about that. 1:18 through 8:39. Are a large unit. We could raise here the question of basic subdivision. Does it come at the end of chapter 4? or at the end of chapter 5. Then 9:1 through 11:36. And 12:1 through 15:13. So that would give a basic indication of basic flow that I don't think anybody is going to argue about too much. All right, any questions, comments that you want to bring up here before we move on? Yes, Drew.
Regarding our papers, since you've covered a lot of this preliminary ground, I'm assuming we don't need to go through a lot of detail.
Yeah, I would think your papers are going to have the character of focusing on particular segment of material or particular issues, so you'd only get into these matters as you would, you know, it would advance your exegetical and theological reflections on the passage. Yes, Ben.
After the page in the letter to Paul, preface for writing the script of the church, I have read comparisons of this as a strategy in Ephesus that by working in one large city he would reach the whole province. Does that impact on how we view the letter as, in some sense, setting a particular beachhead? Doctrines that are both for the church but apologetically important for his thought of how his role, his church is in the region, particularly in of course, the Spain, is that a natural connection?
Yeah, I think that element is certainly there. I don't think, you know, it would be quite parallel with Ephesus because he doesn't see this so much as a beachhead that has to be established, but, you know, especially established by him, it's existing. But it becomes important with a view toward, you know, the regions beyond that yet. He obviously is wanting to enlist their, he doesn't really go into a lot of details, but he obviously wanting to enlist their support. And then, you know, there may be something to, you know, that he's looking toward Rome as he writes with his back toward Jerusalem, or glance back at Jerusalem and what's going to happen there. And getting that support, but I don't think you could draw just a strict parallel with the with an Ephesians strategy. Other than I think it is probably fair to say, especially if you pick up on Borncom's last will and testament idea, it gives Romans then something of a I think you can't get away from the fact that it's addressed to the specific circumstances in Rome. I don't think. There's just too much there. But at least sections, I think, Paul would see as serving a kind of a more of a round-robin approach, as it were. Well, let's live by the bell here, and even though we only have 4 minutes... let's move ahead and start what we're going to be involved in the rest of my time standing up here, and that is what we're calling the exegetical theological notes. And the way we'll proceed here is just in a series, and you'll see how open-ended this is when we get to the end of things. Not in you'll see in a totally arbitrary fashion, but in different directions that have drawn my own interest, especially in the first two chapters. Yes?
Is the way that you're approaching these different passages and the way you'd like us to approach your papers in terms of the methodology and approach?
I would say by no means in a kind of restraining or... I would hope that, you know, you might find something useful in the way I go at things, but you should have fair amount, you should feel flexible there, doing what's comfortable. I guess I suspect your question, not having worked together before, what expectations are. I don't have any strict code or regimen to follow. I think again, that's why I call it exegetical theological. You know, we're all at a point where we have matured somewhat in the handling of scriptures, and I think there'll be various ways of doing exegesis, sound exegesis that, you know, is alerted to the theological issues involved. So, first, there is widespread agreement among the scholars, whoever they are, that nameless blob, that 1:16 through 17 announced the theme of the letter. At least these verses, let's say, provide a thematic statement of the content of the gospel. Don't see how anyone would want to deny that. We have in these verses at least one statement of the content of the gospel, obviously as a theme. And it's that with its implications, that thematic statement, with at least some of the implications involved, that Paul goes on then to develop in the body of the letter. I don't know how anyone would want to quarrel with that, even if we don't make it strictly, in a strict literary sense, the kind of the topic heading. So let's just look at it again, a familiar passage to us all. I'm not ashamed of the gospel. And then there are some who want to argue that this is not really part of the theme, that in effect you have something like a colon, and now the theme is coming. Not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. And then that everyone, you see, is qualified in terms of the central dynamic of redemptive history, Jew and non-Jew, Jew and first and Greek. For in it, and the antecedent is clearly euangelion, in it, in the gospel, the righteousness of God. We'll spend a fair amount of time talking about that. The righteousness of God is revealed, let's just translate here, from faith to faith, as it's written, Habakkuk. The just shall live by faith. All right, we'll start analyzing that when we get back after the break.